Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Benghazi, Why It Matters, presented by the Representative Rob Bishop Civic Engagement Fund. Today's guest is Congressman Jason Chaffetz. Congressman Chaffetz was first elected in 2008 as a Republican U.S. Representative for Utah's 3rd Congressional District. He attended Brigham Young University on an athletic scholarship and was the starting place kicker on the BYU football team in 1988 and 1989. After a successful football career, Congressman Chaffetz earned a degree in communications. Congressman Chaffetz came to Congress with a 16-year history in the local business community, executive branch experience in Utah state government, and a reputation for running strong political campaigns. He successfully ran John Huntsman's campaign for governor as his campaign manager and continued working with him as his chief of staff. Congressman Chaffetz uses time in the governor's office to learn about the federal delegation and the issues that matter to the state of Utah. He's a member of several congressional committees, including the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, where he's the chairman of the Subcommittee on National Security. He also serves on the committees on the Judiciary and on Homeland Security. Please join me in welcoming Congressman Chaffetz.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you very much. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for being here. Thanks to the Hinckley Institute, the University of Utah. My son goes here. I kicked a few footballs down at BYU once upon a time when we used to score touchdowns down there. I'm really a huge fan of the University of Utah as well. What you do and how you do it. I appreciate Kirk Jowers in particular, who's been a good friend and a great institution here. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about something that I think is vital and it is important and can't be simply ignored. You know, our nation is predicated upon good people involved and engaged. We don't suppose that everybody agrees on all issues, but what we do agree on is that a government properly run is going to have some contention. It is going to have some debate. The way our framers set up the Constitution was such that we were going to engage in dialogue. We weren't going to agree on everything. And that through the separation of powers, both the executive branch and the legislative branch, and then even breaking that into the House and the Senate, there would be differing opinions. But there would be oversight as well. And what's imperative in this process is that people are truthful and honest. That you just don't do things just because you can. And one of the things is the more I dive deeper into what was truly one of the great tragedies is that we have a host of statements and a government that is misleading the world and the people of the United States of America about what really happened. That's just not acceptable. Now, we come to this Benghazi situation more than a year after it took place, and on a week when the United States Senate actually did something I didn't know they were actually going to do, led by Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat, who went out and bravely said, along with the panel members that voted for it, as well as the Republicans, in a very bipartisan way, just a couple days ago, said, this was preventable. This should not have happened again. See, we as a nation, we are self-critical. That's how you get better. That's how you improve. We shouldn't be afraid of going back and figuring out what went wrong, as long as we're honest with ourselves, because that's how you solve it and fix it so that it never, ever happens again. In the situation of Benghazi, a terrorist attack from the get-go, the American people have been misled. And it shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have been this way. So what I would like to do is to kind of walk you through some of it and then answer your questions. and bear with me, it's going to take me a little bit to get through it. There's a lot of background here and a lot of things that you probably haven't heard before. And I would challenge you, it's a challenge for myself. What has the Obama administration said about Benghazi that is actually true? You challenge me with that. And we'll talk about the reality of what happened there in Benghazi. So, there's a few people that you need to know about. These are the four Americans who lost their lives. Ambassador Chris Stevens, Glenn Doherty. Glenn Doherty, by the way, loves Snowbird. They actually did a ceremony up at Snowbird, honoring him. Came here to Utah a lot. Tyrone Woods. I probably spent more time with his father than just about any one of these families. Amazing family. And Sean Smith, who was new on the job, just gotten there. These people lost their lives. They were serving their country. I don't care what political affiliation they are. They were serving their nation. And God bless them. And we always remember them and not forget the service and sacrifice that they've made and that so many others before them have. And also, to properly understand this story, you have to understand a fellow Utahn by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Andy Wood. Let me tell you what happened, because I don't think this story has been told before. Certainly not in a forum like this. Shortly after Benghazi, the attack happened, I happened to be the chairman on the oversight committee. I'm the subcommittee chairman on national security, which includes homeland defense and foreign operations. And as we watched this unfold on television, some of the things didn't seem quite right. One of our interns, who's in our office, we get about 10,000 emails and letters a month. One of our interns got an email. She had been on the job for about 2 weeks. She fortunately pulled out an email that was a little different than the rest of the others, and she said, "I think the congressman ought to read this one." And I read it. It was from him. And he had been trying to contact some other senators and other people to say, "I actually know a lot about Libya, and I think I need to tell you." And Andy Wood is in the Utah National Guard. And we met down at the SCIF, a secure communications facility, there at the Utah National Guard headquarters at the Point of the Mountain. And for a few hours, he laid out his background and what he had experienced in Libya. See, the Pentagon had some assets there in Libya. Even though they were trying not to put any, quote, boots on the ground, he was the senior most Pentagon official on the ground until August of 2012. Our lead person. And he walked me through the series of events that eventually led to what I consider a death trap there in Benghazi. He's testified before Congress. He has gone on shows from 60 Minutes and others. And a brave individual for stepping forward and doing so. He's an important part of this story. You also have to know about Gregory Hicks, Department of State, Foreign Service officer. I believe he served in the Foreign Service for more than 30 years. Amazing background. He was the Deputy Chief of Mission, number two to Ambassador Chris Stevens. When the ambassador went missing and went down, he was the lead person in Libya for the United States government. Eric Nordstrom. You'll hear me talk about RSOs. RSO is a regional security officer. That is the lead security officer appointed by the State Department. You have personnel from the Pentagon. You have personnel from the State Department. This gentleman was the head of security in Libya leading up until August of 2012. Again, an expert on what was happening on the ground there in Libya. Also need to know about Charlene Lamb. And there are other people that, obviously, Secretary Clinton, Ambassador Rice. I mean, I'm assuming you know who those people are. Charlene Lamb is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Programs, the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Basically, all the RSOs in the world focus up and funnel through her. Okay? And then Ambassador Patrick Kennedy is the Undersecretary for Management. So you have management. Management oversees the security. These people were in charge of security for Secretary Clinton. You just need to know these personalities. Now, also to properly understand this, I want to refresh you on the map here, because here's the outline of Libya, rather large country in northern Africa. But I want you to pay attention to this line right here, which is Egypt, a very difficult border to control. Wide open deserts, not a lot of checkpoints, not a lot of roads. but deep concern for the United States government that you have weapons trafficked going into these areas. And if you look at the proximity to Israel, you can understand why there's so much concern. We could have a whole separate discussion on a place I was just at in the Sinai Peninsula there in Egypt. It was just a number of weeks ago. I went to Tripoli and I went into Egypt. I can't tell you all the details about all the stuff that I've seen because most everything is classified. I'm just telling you, you can see the flow of concern there. Okay? The ability to transport weapons and have nefarious characters cross borders is very, very difficult to monitor, to say the least. This represents Tripoli. Notice its proximity to Tunisia. It used to be whenever we had foreign service officers going to serve in the Middle East, they would go to Tunisia and they would go to language school. That doesn't happen anymore because the bad guys figured it out and it was a security concern. We don't do that anymore. I can't tell you what we do now, but I can tell you that Tunisia plays a very pivotal role. If you remember the awakening in the Middle East, some of the things that happened out of Tunisia. I was in Tunisia weeks before that went down. Right here, which you have to understand, this distance right here is like here to Phoenix, okay? That's about the proximity here, okay? That is Benghazi, okay? Benghazi is about the size of Provo. It's not a huge town. It's right by the ocean, part of eastern Libya. You get down to these deserts here, not much going on. There's one town down here we pay a lot of attention to, but you look in here, you get Benghazi, and then you have Darna. These are things that we've been paying attention to as a government for our own safety and security, the world's safety and security for a long time. But I also want you to notice all the European assets that are here, okay? Rota becomes very important in this. Sigonella. We have a big presence at Sigonella. We were part of NATO when we started bombing Libya. For months, the American campaign helped bomb Libya to take down Muammar Gaddafi. How did we do it? Rota, Sigonella, the Italians, the Spaniards, the French. Look at all these people right here. We have a huge, massive base right there. It's called AFRICOM. AFRICOM is in charge of everything except Egypt in Africa. So the world is divided in several different places, and when you look at the military control of our assets, it's a fairly new assignment, but AFRICOM, under the direction of General Hamm, controls the military assets in all of Africa except Egypt. Okay? And that's in part because we have such great concerns between Egypt and Jordan and Israel and all that. That comes under a separate command. But I want you to just digest the assets and the proximity to Europe. I do not buy that the United States military could not provide assets in 24 hours. I see no scenario under which that could possibly be true. Now, we've heard different scenarios. Remember, I'll keep going. I'm going to talk about three areas, three buckets, okay? This is kind of how I segmented my own mind, before, during, and after, okay? Before, during, and after. So I just want you to give you your sense of kind of why this is so important. After the fall of Muammar Gaddafi, a dictator for 40-plus years, you have a country that has little to no assets in terms for the people, electricity, basic things. It's such a third world country, you can't even imagine. I've been there a couple times now. Not the safest place to go here. During the revolution, our embassy, which is more downtown Tripoli, was burned and graffiti and just demolished to the point that we had to open up a new facility, which is closer to the airport. I can't show you pictures. For their own safety and security, they'd rather not me show you pictures. But it's in a much more rural setting than downtown Tripoli. This is important because that is where the command and control of a lot of what was happening, where obviously the majority of our assets were in Libya, were there at the embassy outside of Tripoli. Okay, but as a war-torn country, we did, though, very quickly go and open up a consulate office, or sometimes they'll say, well, it's not officially a consulate, but it was another facility of ours, a branch of ours, if you will. We were paying $70,000 a month to operate this facility in Benghazi. And there are a variety of reasons why the State Department wanted to have a presence there. Through this time, and I got to skip and fast forward a lot, when you have Eric Nordstrom and you have Lieutenant Colonel Wood, there were more than 300 document security incidents there in Libya. And there were a whole range of car bombings and shootings. And it's a very dangerous place. Most nights, people that live there will tell you, you can regularly hear gunfire. When I was there a couple of weeks ago, I met with the deputy, with the interior minister, who was also the deputy prime minister. When we came out of the building, you could hear gunshots being fired. I'm not saying they were being fired at me, but you could hear gunshots, and the security was shuffling us in those cars about as fast as you can get. It's the Wild West. At one point, the running route of the ambassador was pasted on Facebook with a threat that they were going to take down the ambassador. The security situation was very, very difficult, to say the least. This was routinely reported up through the channels to the point that they were asking routinely for fortification of the physical facilities, and they wanted more personnel. The bottom line is, the personnel, they didn't even get to keep what they had. They diminished the number of personnel. We're talking about less than 20 to getting down even less than that. Big security concerns in Benghazi. You have to understand the situation in Benghazi. March of 2012, He's asking very specifically for additional security as early as March of 2012. But he got no response, no positive thing. Most people don't know this about Benghazi, but our facility in Benghazi was bombed on April 6th of 2012. They found who did it. They let him go. Didn't prosecute him, nothing. Just let him go. Said, oh, we better not. We just... 2 months later, June 6, 2012, early in the morning, they come up and they bomb this wall of our facility. These are pictures. Well, I can't tell you where I got all these pictures, but they basically came and just blew out the wall. This is the vehicle where it stopped, put the improvised explosive device on the wall, breached the wall. What happened during that time when they got out of the car, breached the wall, did all? Nothing. Nothing. Nothing happened. We didn't chase them. We didn't shoot them. We got a little video. Did anybody approach them? No. Nothing. What we were doing is we were hiring local Libyans to do security. At one point, they hired a person who was a local mobile phone salesman. They liked him. He was good at selling phones. So he'd be good. Let's give him a radio. That was the extent of our security that we were doing outside on the perimeter of these facilities. Do you think anything happened after this bombing? No, nothing. Nothing happened. Twice it had been bombed. What happened 5 days after this? Assassination attempt on the British ambassador, whose facility was just less than 2 kilometers away from where we were. You had this rocket-propelled grenade going through and trying to take these people out. Now, it's amazing. I mean, you can see the blood all over the place here. He had diplomatic plates, 2-car convoy, didn't kill anybody. Amazing that nobody died in that. This happened 5 days after they bombed our facility. There are reports now going back to headquarters at the State Department saying Al-Qaeda is flying flags over government buildings. Every Western country left Benghazi, except the United States. Every one of us left. This is the British, the diplomatic compound. They come out, go this way. Here's the rocket attack. In very close proximity here is our U.S. facility. At one point, the Red Cross is bombed in the middle of the night. There's a written correspondence that goes out and says, the reason we bombed it at night is we only want to kill Christians and Americans. We don't want to kill locals. And so what did the Red Cross do? They skedaddled. I mean, when you bomb in that facility as well, you're going to get out of town. This is when Lieutenant Colonel Andy Wood, and this is what he said in the testimony before our House committee, it was apparent to me that we were the last Western flag flying in Benghazi. We were the last thing on their target list to remove from Benghazi. And these are the reports that are going to the State Department. What did Hillary Clinton want to do? She wanted to expand the facility. She planned to visit the facility at the end of the year. And yet we were diminishing and lessening the security profile in Benghazi. It does not add up. I wish I could tell you exactly how they could come to those conclusions, but that's why we're asking questions. Given all this background and all this atmosphere and everything that's happening, how is it that the ambassador goes to Benghazi in part because he believes we're going to expand the facility and the secretary is going to visit before the end of the year, and everybody else is leaving? Everybody else sees it. And we got Al-Qaeda flying flags over government buildings. You can go to YouTube and pull up video of parades of these militants having not exactly the Freedom Festival parade or Days of 47 parade. Their parade looks a little different than ours, with guns and backs of pickup trucks and whatnot. It's amazing. Let's talk about during the attack. It's September 11th. The White House puts out a statement that we are forward-leaning around the globe. We are prepared for any attack that might come out this way. Guess what? That was never true. That was pure propaganda. We have heard from every military person that I've had in a classified and unclassified briefing tell us nobody was leaning forward. Nobody was prepared. And yet the White House put out all this propaganda and said, yes, we were. Guess what? You're working in one of these facilities. You hope that the White House is on top of this. You hope that the White House is getting everybody forward-leaning. Nope. Let's remember that 9 hours earlier in Egypt, people were coming over the wall, attacking our embassy and tore down our flag. Did anybody decide to maybe turn on those, get those fuel tankers ready? Hey, let's maybe get some military folks up out of bed. None. I can find not a single case of anybody telling anybody in the United States military, this might get a little worse, folks. Let's at least get ready. Nothing. Ambassador goes to bed, he stays in the facility the entire time, doesn't go out that day, has several visitors. The Turkish ambassador comes and visits last. They kind of close the gate. About 9 o'clock, all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose. And the fight is on. There are multiple, let me put it this way. When I went to Libya 21 days after the attack, I was there the entire time I was there. There is not a single person who I talked to, met with, discussed, who ever even mentioned a video. Didn't even mention it because it never happened. There was no protest. The protocol for a protest is very different than what you do when you're under attack. In fact, one of the things that came out on Monday was a transcript. You can look it up from House Armed Services. I was sitting in that meeting when they were asked about from General Carter, or from Carter Ham, who's the four-star general over AFRICOM, and he was asked very directly about what he thought. Was it a terrorist attack or was it a video? He said, oh no, we figured out in a few minutes that it was a terrorist attack. Overwhelming force. Basically, by about 10 p.m., we had lost our ambassador. We didn't know where he was. We thought we knew where he was. It wasn't until 3 o'clock the next morning, or hours later, that we got the initial report that he was at the hospital, and he may be dead, but he might be alive. Our military being a little smarter, some of those CIA guys and others being a little smart, said, yeah, we better not go to the hospital right away. That might be a trap. See, Ansar al-Sharia, who does have ties to al-Qaeda, we had this back and forth, right? New York Times comes out, says no ties to al-Qaeda. Bipartisan people who are on the Intelligence Committee have come out and said, clearly Ansar al-Sharia has ties to al-Qaeda. Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia, Remember, that's why I showed you on the map. Also has ties, is somewhat implicated. And some others, Katala and some of these other nefarious characters have some very nefarious ties. But basically, during the attack, it starts at 9:42, it gets to 10 o'clock, we're missing the ambassador. At some point, they make a dash over to the annex. At some point, I hope to be able to tell you about that. I can't tell you about it now. But suffice to say, the entire time, there was gunfire, there were probing fire, there were other things happening. There gets to be a little bit of a lull, and then kaboom, another major attack on the annex, and that's when we lost Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty. We had a team of just two people that have some military ties and whatnot. They got on a plane. They flew from Tripoli to Benghazi. The hours they were stuck at the airport, couldn't get to our facility, which should be a very short drive. It's like going from here to the airport, you know, our airport. But they couldn't make the journey. One of the more disturbing things about this whole attack here is that we had a lot of discussion about, was there a stand-down order? Thing that's gotten almost no ink since it came out on Monday is Lieutenant Colonel Gibson. I questioned Colonel Gibson in a classified hearing. They released the transcript of it. He had asked, and he classified it this way, actually. He said, I told AFRICOM that I was going to go engage in the fight. They had a four-man team, including a medic. That four-man team was denied the ability to go from Tripoli to Benghazi and engage in the fight. Again, what most people don't realize is Ansar al-Sharia had said we were going to attack the embassy in Tripoli as well, taking claim for this. So what did the people at the personnel at the embassy did? They evacuated. They went to another facility. That's how serious the threat was. That's why we took it very seriously. They did the right thing. But once they had secured that facility there in Tripoli, you had a four-man military team. These are people who know how to fire guns. Okay, this is not the February 17th Brigade. It's a bunch of, you know, former mobile phone salesmen. The fight's on. We got people down. At one point, one of these people is bleeding so bad they have to put on their own tourniquet. He eventually bled out, and he's dead. We had no medic. And yet that four-person team, they had a medic. They were denied going. And the Pentagon to this day denies this. And yet we heard testimony from the person who was on the phone trying to do it himself. It shouldn't have happened that way. And a lot of this is ex post facto. It just infuriates me. This is the facility in Benghazi. It's several acres. You've seen not only the graffiti and the attacks and the mayhem that is there. We have still never cleaned this up, by the way. It's still sitting there just kind of like this. One of the things, and I could do an hour on just this part. One of the most disturbing things about this attack is our ability to do the exfil, as they call it, the ability to evacuate the wounded. Now remember that map, okay? What if this was Mozambique, or what if this was Zambia, or what if this was somewhere that truly is far away? That's about as close as you get. Now, during the attack, remember I showed you on that map. In fact, let me see if I can pull this up here. Let me go back to this one real quick, pull up the map. The military has said they could never get there in time. Nothing was ready. But I also asked, did they ever ask the Libyans for air clearance? The answer is no. I've asked them, did they ever ask their NATO partners if they could help? The answer is no. We conducted multiple months of an air campaign with them. We heard testimony that said, what if we did a flyover? Have you ever been to a parade when you had a flyover? You got that surge of patriotism that comes through. Imagine an F-16 or a Tornado, which is very similar to an F-16, 200 feet above the deck at the speed of sound, letting them know that America's there. That didn't happen. They didn't even ask. Carter Ham testified before Congress that 1 hour into this fight, he thought it was over. President Obama says, We did everything we could. We threw every asset at it. That's not true, Mr. President. That's never been true. They thought they were in recovery mode. They were wrong. And we had two more people die. We also have some that are maimed and injured beyond you can even believe. Person who spent more than a year in a hospital. So don't have the President of the United States, don't have the Secretary of State, don't have the Secretary of Defense tell America and the world they did everything they could when your four-star general who was in charge of it said, that's not what we did. That's what he testified. And that's why it's so infuriating. Right here, Sigonella, there were more than 50 tornadoes on the deck. Flight time to Benghazi, 35 minutes. All right, let me go back here. So what happens afterwards? And then we'll get to the questions. I'm going to tell you, then we'll watch the video. The first person you're going to see is the president of Libya. Okay? This is on that Sunday show where Susan Rice appears. This is the president of Libya. What you're going to hear also, I'll get to a clip, is Trey Gowdy, my colleague from South Carolina, who's equally as passionate about this as I am. We have a memo from the State Department internally. Remember, this thing starts on September 11th, 1942. It goes all the way through the night into September 12th. On September 12th, internally, the State Department says, this is Ansar al-Sharia. It's these Islamic terrorists that are committing this attack. We knew from the get-go. We knew immediately it was terrorists. We knew immediately they had ties to al-Qaeda. There was no doubt then. But that story morphed and changed. What you'll hear them say is, we, the United States government, told the Libyans who did this. And the president of Libya is about to tell you, this is who did it. And then minutes later, after they go to commercial, Susan Rice comes on and starts perpetuating this lie that there was some sort of video protest going on. And then Gowdy will come back on and say, well, here's the evidence of why we knew that you thought this was true. And then the infuriating part is your government, my government, trying to tell everybody, guess what, this is just a phony scandal. Hold on, let's make sure this volume's up.
That leads us to conclude that this was premeditated or pre-planned.
It's not what they told the Libyans, as Mr. Gowdy will point out.
Beth Jones is the acting assistant secretary for Near Eastern Affairs at the State Department.
I want to read an excerpt from an email she sent. I spoke to the Libyan ambassador and emphasized the importance of Libyan leaders continuing to make strong statements. By the way, Mr. Hicks, this email was sent on September
1st. It's up to just later.
The day after Benghazi, and several days before Ambassador Rice's television appearance. And I'll continue. When he said his government suspected that former Gaddafi regime elements carried out the attacks, I told him that the group that conducted the attacks, Ansar al-Sharia, is affiliated with Islamic terrorists. Let me say that again, Mr. Hicks. She told him, the State Department, on September the 12th, days before our ambassador went on national television, is telling the ambassador to Libya, the group that conducted the attacks, Ansar al-Sharia, is affiliated with Islamic terrorists.
What does Hillary Clinton say about this?
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
Seriously?
Benghazi happened a long time ago.
This parade of distractions and political posturing and phony scandals.
We need to put behind us the distractions and the phony debates and nonsense.
Fake scandals, phony scandals that have captured the attention of many here in Washington only to dissipate. The phony scandals that have consumed so much attention here all to come to naught.
Jay Carney was asked to clarify what he believed a phony scandal was, and he said the IRS scandal in Benghazi. He listed two. He thinks that this is all just made up. It's phony. That's why I got a problem with it. All right, let me transition, and I appreciate your indulgence. Let's try to answer whatever questions you have. I've been way too close to this, and some of this may not make some sense, or you have some questions, but please, whatever questions in the time that we have left. Let me put up that slide. I think that'll helpful with the...
Good afternoon.
Hey.
All right, you talk about...
I don't need a microphone. Thank you. Oh, they're broadcasting on the radio. So.
Well, you find it infuriating, this cover-up of the attack in Benghazi. I find it infuriating that there were 13 similar attacks during the Bush administration's times, three of which in Karachi, two of which were in Saudi Arabia. These are countries with... stable governments, and one in India, which is of course an ally of the United States. Stable governments, allies of the United States. Yet there were still embarrassing lapses in security there. And this is not even to mention the attacks in Amman, the attacks in Bali, the attacks in Madrid and London, and of course the 9/11 attacks. Now it follows logically that if somebody plots something out, it can be followed back to its source. But in a country that is under a civil war with a broken repressive dictatorship that's just been removed from power, I feel it's a bit more understandable that a terrorist attack might happen there. So I would, my question would be, how would you respond to the 13 similar attacks on U.S. consulates and embassies during the Bush administration, and how would they contrast so greatly with the predictable attack in Libya. Thank you.
My quick response to that is I would never label those other attacks as phony. We should pursue and make sure we find the perpetrators as fast and swiftly as we possibly can. You have to work with the host government to try to hold them accountable. One of the things we heard testimony is our State Department tells the president of Libya, we think it was Ansar al-Sharia, it was Islamic terrorists that did it, only to go on national television and embarrass them. By totally contradicting him and saying, well, that's what the president just said is not true. What really happened was this video and this, you know, and there was this protest, which nobody, even the Accountability Review Board, which came back, appointed by Hillary Clinton, came back and said, that's just not true. I mean, I don't think there should be any doubt in anybody's mind that that was fiction, it was a lie, it was made up, it never ever happened. You're going to get attacked in no matter what administration is. But you got to pay attention to it. You got to take seriously. And one of the things I have a problem with is the facility here in Benghazi was attacked twice before, and we didn't do anything about it. What did we do? We lessened the security profile. We didn't improve the security profile. I got a real problem with that. And the fact that we have somebody go down and we got people injured and maimed and killed, and we can't get any. You can get on a Delta flight in Salt Lake City, fly to Paris, change planes, fly to Tripoli faster than our military responded. I don't understand, for instance, when we know we have a person down, that the C-17 out of Stuttgart, Germany, wasn't even asked to fire up and get ready until 6 a.m. It was 2:15 p.m. before it even left Germany, and it didn't get back to Germany that night with the wounded, a guy who's been in the hospital for more than a year now, until after 10:15 p.m. that night. We're better than that. We spend $600 billion a year to have the biggest, baddest military on the face of the planet. And you can't get to Libya for more than 24 hours? Are you kidding me? Of course we got to pay attention to each and every one of those. The last thing, two other things. It took our FBI 18 days to get to Benghazi. Now, the comparison I like to make is Boston. Boston was a terrorist attack. Boston had four Americans killed. Would you put up with an FBI that shows up 18 days later? And one of the things that should concern everybody in this room is we have never, in the public, ever, have we heard from a person who was on the ground that night in Benghazi. What? Are you kidding? Why is that? Doesn't that, like, make you scratch your head? Not a single person? It's because this administration are doing everything they can possibly do to prevent that. So we got to pay attention to all of them, not just some of them. And when we got four dead Americans, we're not going to take that lightly, no matter what the administration is. But thanks for the question. Appreciate it.
Okay. My name's Jenica Jessen. I'm a political science major here at the U. And my big question is, what do we do about it? Yes, this was a disaster. Yes, a lot of things went wrong. Yes, it was bungled and there were mistakes. How do we resolve this going forward? How do we make sure
that people are held responsible?
Are we doing anything now?
So, thank you for that question. When our Marine barracks in Lebanon was bombed, they created a commission that was called the Inman Commission. And the Inman Commission went back and said, you know what, there's some very basic standards that we have to have for the facilities where we're going to put Americans overseas. And they're called the Inman Standards. Problem is, when I went into Tripoli, and certainly in Benghazi, these buildings were never made to code. Now, if you try to build a home here in Salt Lake City, you're going to have a building inspector come on out and say, well, I'm sorry, the electricity is not really put in this. You can't move in until it's fixed. We have embassies. This is why I got great concern. You got terrorists out there who've now killed four Americans three times at one facility in Benghazi. We've never captured or killed anybody. Do you think they're going to do it again? Yeah, I think they're probably going to say, oh, there's a formula that works. The Americans don't have the personnel, and they don't have the physical fortification of those buildings. We thought we had learned lessons back in the Reagan administration, but evidently the Bush administration and the Clinton administration and moving forward never learned those lessons. We got to capture and kill those people. You can't have an FBI that takes 18 days to even show up. And we've got to be smarter about how we're doing security overseas. It's just, it's not an easy fix. If it was easy, I'm sure it was done. Here's one of my deep criticisms of Secretary Clinton. I'm trying not to be political here, but she's the Secretary of State. She has billions of dollars at her disposal, thousands of employees. In 90 days, the Accountability Review Board came in, five people with six staff. Okay, in 90 days, they found 29 systemic problems and failures. 29. Now, one of the recommendations from the Accountability Review Board is to come up with the best practices. They came up with 40 recommendations. 40. Are they implementing all of those changes? How is it that we had 29 systemic problems that they believe led to this attack, and yet not a single person was fired? Every one of those people at the State Department, in charge and responsible for all this, I'm not going to hold anybody in ill will because we were attacked. I have a problem, though, with how we respond to it if we're not prepared for it. And that's the concern. That's the concern.
Hello, Congressman Chaffetz. My name is Kurt Manwaring, and I'm a political science major here. And my question for you, I'm obviously going to try and ask this with the most care and sensitivity I possibly can, because obviously this was a real tragedy with American lives lost, and I think everyone agrees there were serious mistakes made. However, as a kind of casual observer to this, I've sort of noticed two prongs, or I guess purposes, of the investigations and oversight commissions and all that. One of them seems to be holding people accountable for what happened, for their mistakes, and the second seems to be trying to keep this from happening again, or minimizing that chance as much as possible. My question for you is with Congress's attention obviously divided, a whole myriad of issues facing our country. Which one of those purposes is more important to you? And if you could only choose one, which would it be? Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We got to be able to walk and chew gum, too. It's a very complex world with so many moving parts. The federal government spends $3.6 trillion. We got over 2 million federal employees. We have hundreds of embassies and consulates and thousands of people serving overseas. I guess one comes before the other. If you don't fully understand what happened, you have a hard time fixing it moving forward. That's just a principle in general. The front page of the Accountability Review Board report, I wish I had memorized the quote. I didn't, but it starts with a quote that says, if you don't understand the history, you're bound to repeat it. So I guess if I had to prioritize something, we better darn well understand everything we can possibly understand here and prevent it from happening again. And everything I do, I guess, is involved and engaged in politics, but I'm trying to be as objective as I possibly can. There are some really good, heroic, amazing things that should not be forgotten. If you look at what Glenn Doherty did before he was killed, amazing, an American hero. There are the people that acted that night who were on the ground, they are heroes. They did not ask to be in this situation, and they acted in an amazing, heroic way. So that should be noted as well.
I'm pretty lay when it comes to political rhetoric, but I do have a question of what are we doing specifically with the legislature in preventing these things in the future? You kind of generally responded to that question, and I guess we're looking for specific answers to what are we specifically doing for these things in the future when we've got things like rules of engagement, avoiding these like war situations in the future. As these are embassies, our whole goal is to establish peace,
right?
And we don't want to be, you know,
right, right. No, it's a great point, because if you were gonna build a facility that never ever came under attack, you'd probably build it underground. But that's not the purpose of why we're trying to engage in that country, right? We're there to help Americans, to have dialogue with the local country, to have working friendly relationships. There are some basic minimal standards that have to be met. I would point specifically the 29 recommendations from the Accountability Review Board. There was a recommendation after the bombing in Kenya years and years ago that there be somebody at the undersecretary level that is specific to security rather than just part of management who is first and foremost looking out for security. Each State Department, Bush and Obama administrations, have both resisted that. But again, another recommendation that continues to go forward. We are going to have to look at the budgets here. And I think there's also a philosophical debate. And this is something that I peppered the chairman of the Joint Chiefs with when I said, now, when the crap's hitting the fan, who makes the decision? Is it the Pentagon or is it the State Department? In this case, it was the State Department, as best I can tell. And the example I will use is we had what are called FAST teams. FAST team was a group of Marines, not to engage in the fight, but to come in and protect our embassy in Tripoli. They were stood up, and they wanted to get into it. And in doing so, they were told to change out of their uniforms and into their plain clothes. Military personnel wear uniforms for a reason. We like to know who we are, so you're not firing at each other. You have to carry communications gear. You have to carry weapons. You have to carry ammunition. You've got to carry all sorts of gear. Each uniform costs over $1,000 a piece, and yet they were on the boarding the plane. They were told to get off, change back into their jeans and T-shirts. And I said to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, seriously, are you kidding me? You're telling me that some State Department person told you to get off the plane and we got a fight going on, we got people dying, and you guys got there an hour later because somebody told you were inappropriately dressed? Who should make that decision? It seems to me that our United States military in the middle of the fight should be making those decisions. But we got to have that debate in this country. We got about 3 minutes, so I'll hustle through.
Okay. Yep. Good afternoon, Congressman Chaffetz. I want to thank you. About a year ago, you actually called me on my personal cell phone after I gave it to the Republican House Chair, and you discussed the one of
lucky
your,
me.
I know.
Yeah, that's good.
One of my questions when I was voting for the first time, I just want to thank you. That means a lot to a voter. Take the
sure,
personal
thank
time.
Thank you.
My question is, I have a loved one that recently reported to the embassy in Morocco about a week ago, and I want to know that, or if there is anything we can do if we receive some sort of communication, like has been sent through email or some sort of message like that, and it notes that there's a dangerous situation going on. Is there anything we can do to help them respond to this?
Well, first of all, thanks for his service. I want to thank all the you all inevitably probably have a relative somewhere who serves in our United States military or serves in our foreign service and represents the United States of America. Communication is important. Morocco is one of our best partners. It's our sister with the Utah National Guard. We interact a lot with the Moroccans. It's one of the great allies of the United States of America. Be happy to chat with you more specifically about that type of situation. But in these waning moment here, few moments here, let me just say, the United States of America, it's the greatest country on the face of the planet. What these men and women are doing now, they've done for the last couple hundred years, it's truly amazing. I would just plead with you, implore that we can't just gloss over these types of things. One of the most offensive parts of this to me is to hear the President of the United States, the spokesperson for the president, say that this is just phony. And I can't imagine that they would say that to the families if they were sitting before the president. But I can tell you, each one of those families, particularly the Woods and Sean Smith's family, have said, you know, they promised that they were going to do something, that they would tell me what truly happened. Our nation truly doesn't know what happened that night. I want to get to the truth. I want to be able to hear from the people that were on the ground and survive that. And I want to make sure that it never happens again. But I also appreciate a country that it can allow a representative to go out and criticize the president, draw attention to this, have this debate and discussion without repercussion. That is quite miraculous here in the United States of America, different than how most every other country in the world is. But ladies and gentlemen, we have to pay attention. This is no phony scandal. And there's still a lot more to learn. So, again, I thank you for your indulgence. I appreciate your time. And thanks also for the very good pizza from Wasatch Pizza. Is that Wasatch Pizza? Good pizza. Thanks to the Hinckley Institute. Thanks to the University of Utah. I truly do appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Congressman Chaffetz.